Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Awesome. Well, today we're going back in time to the early 1900s, the American South. We're exploring W.E.B. Du Bois, and specifically his book, The Social Evolution of the Black South.
Fascinating period. So much change happening.
Absolutely, yeah. Transition from plantation life to the rise of cities. And you know what's amazing?
What's that?
It's how much of what Du Bois observed still resonates, over a century later.
Oh, absolutely. His analysis is like surprisingly relevant to today's issues.
Okay, so let's jump right in. One of the things that really stood out to me was how Du Bois framed plantation life as a monarchy.
Yeah, a monarchy, right? Not just like the obvious power imbalance, but the whole system of control.
Yeah, it was like,
The plantation owner was like a king,
yeah,
basically.
dictating every aspect of life for, well, everyone who lived and worked there.
Exactly. No freedom, no autonomy.
It's a pretty stark picture, right? And then on top of that, you have this limited social interaction.
Right, very controlled environment. Du Bois talks about Christmas frolics and church services as like the main outlets for
So
socializing.
important, though, right?
Oh, crucial. Not just about celebration or faith. These gatherings were how they, maintain their community, their sense of identity in the face of such oppression.
It's amazing to think about how those gatherings evolved, too,
Yeah.
with blending African traditions with Christian
It's
elements.
fascinating.
Du Bois argues this fusion, this sort of blending, created this unique cultural tapestry that still influences Black communities today.
Oh, for sure. It's woven into the fabric of their culture,
Definitely. And, it wasn't just this monolithic community, was it?
Right. Even within slavery, Du Bois observed distinct social classes emerging, adds another layer of complexity to the whole plantation hierarchy.
Absolutely. So we've got this power dynamic, right, between the owner and everyone else. But then within the enslaved population, there's further division.
Yeah, exactly. He focuses on two groups in particular, skilled artisans and house servants.
And those roles, those specific roles, would have a ripple effect later on as Black communities transition to city life, right?
Oh, absolutely. The seeds of what we see later are planted right there in those roles.
Fascinating. Okay, so let's unpack that a bit. First, the artisans, right? Carpenters, blacksmiths, people whose skills were essential. What was Du Bois' take on them?
Well, he saw them as having a certain leverage, and
Interesting.
their skills gave them power.
Okay, I see.
Even in that system, some artisans were able to buy their freedom. Think about that.
That's remarkable.
It shows you the value placed on their labor, even within a system designed to dehumanize them.
A glimmer of agency there, right? In the midst of such a dehumanizing environment.
Exactly. And then you have the house servants. Totally different dynamic.
Right, completely different set of circumstances. So what did Du Bois observe there?
Well, their proximity to the master's power, created this really complex web of relationships.
Right, closer to the power structure, but still, subservient.
Yeah, they were privy to information, resources that those working in the fields weren't, but also susceptible to a different kind of control.
Like psychological manipulation.
Exactly. Blurred lines between servitude and familial ties, even, really picks up on the potential for manipulation there, that psychological pressure.
It's a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, they might have had access to some education, some comforts, but on the other, that constant threat of being used, manipulated, it's a tough position to be in.
Definitely. And you can see how these roles, the artisan and the house servant, feed into the urbanization of Black communities later.
Right, you start to see the roots of social stratification even during slavery.
Exactly. The skills of the artisans become sought after in the growing cities.
And the house servants, some with more education or social capital, they step into the leadership roles in those new communities.
It's a direct link, and it just shows how complex this period was, right? It's not just about external forces, it's about the internal dynamics within these communities as well.
Definitely. It's a good reminder that even today, the fight for equality isn't just about dismantling external systems, but also addressing those internal hierarchies and disparities that hold people back.
Couldn't agree more.
Okay, so we've laid some groundwork here. We've got this picture of plantation life, these emerging social classes, and the beginnings of a transition to urban life. Now let's dive into that urban landscape in our next segment, shall we?
Let's do it. I'm eager to see how these dynamics play out as these communities navigate a new environment, a new set of challenges and opportunities. All right, so we're moving from those rural plantations into a new setting, the bustling cities of the South. Imagine for a second you're a Black resident in, say, Atlanta, early 1900s.
Okay, yeah.
Daily life is happening within a community that's largely separated from the white population. Living, working, socializing, it's all happening within this distinct sphere.
Yeah, it's a different world than those plantations, but it makes you wonder, like, do the power dynamics really change all that much?
That's the question, isn't it? Dubois used these terms, differentiation and integration, to describe this new urban reality.
Okay, differentiation and integration.
So differentiation, that's the enforced separation, segregation, basically.
So not integration like we usually think of it today, right?
Exactly. Integration in this context meant something different. It was about creating a self-sufficient black community. Think about it. If you're excluded from white businesses, white institutions, you have to build your own.
And that's exactly what happened, right? A whole system of black-owned businesses pops up. Schools, churches, newspapers, insurance companies, even funeral homes, everything, basically.
Amazing, right? They had to create their own world within this segregated society. It speaks to their resilience, this drive to thrive, despite the limitations. But Dubois also points out that the economic picture was complicated.
Right, because it wasn't just about creating these parallel structures, there was still interaction with the larger southern economy, and that couldn't have been easy.
You got it. Some black professionals, doctors, lawyers, they served black clientele mostly, but others, laborers especially, they were integrated into the wider economy, but often in those low-paying, exploitative jobs.
So it's like this double-edged sword. They're building their own institutions, their own spaces, but these divisions, they persist, don't they?
Exactly. You have a working class, a growing professional class, and then those trapped in poverty. It makes you think about the challenges of collective action, right?
How do you bridge those gaps? How do you build solidarity when everyone's dealing with such different realities?
Big questions. And they're still relevant today, right? How do we address economic disparities? How do we create opportunities for everyone? These are things Dubois was grappling with way back then.
Absolutely. It's not a simple problem at all. And this leads us to another really crucial part of Dubois' work, his observation about this moral strain that segregation put on both black and white Southerners.
Oh, yeah, he felt it was corrosive, this system built on lies and injustice.
Right. White Southerners claiming racial superiority while enacting these clearly unjust policies, and black Southerners having to navigate this web of dehumanizing laws and social customs, constantly weighing the risks of resistance.
Just a constant pressure cooker, right?
Exactly. And that moral strain, well, it showed up in different ways, didn't it? Dubois pointed out some folks just lied, pretended everything was fine. Others fought back, risked everything. And then there were those who retreated into silence, just carried that pain and anger alone.
So many different responses to this immense pressure. It makes you think, how would I react in that situation? You know, it's a powerful observation and a really heartbreaking one.
Yeah, it's heavy stuff, right? To think about those choices, that weight of constantly having to choose between like going along with it or resisting. But, you know, Dubois didn't just like point out the problem. He offered some ways forward too, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. For him, silence and deception just made things worse, you know?
Right, just kick the can down the road.
Exactly. He believed in confronting it head on, speaking truth to power, even when it was risky. And he really saw education for both black and white communities as key to breaking down those harmful systems.
And you know, that focus on education, on understanding the history and context of all this, it feels so relevant today, right?
Oh, totally. Especially with all the debates about how history's taught, whose stories get told, how we even begin to talk about racism and inequality.
If we don't have that shared understanding, that acknowledgement of the past, you know, how can we even start to talk about solutions?
It's fundamental. Without that, it's just all surface level. We need to dig deeper, right? Like we're doing here.
Exactly. And you know, another thing that struck me from Dubois' work is that emphasis on agency. Brown communities taking charge, shaping their own destinies.
Oh, yeah, that comes through strong. Like in his analysis of those black-owned businesses and services we talked about, it wasn't just survival, it was empowerment.
Right, creating opportunities from within.
Building something of their own on their own terms.
So it's not just about understanding the big picture, the history. It's also about thinking and acting locally, right? What are the problems in our own communities? What can we do right here, right now?
Exactly. It could be anything, supporting local businesses, volunteering, mentoring young people, even just having those tough conversations about race.
Every little bit counts, right?
Absolutely. Every action adds to that bigger movement for change. And you know, that really connects back to what we do here with this podcast, right? Empowering residents of Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena to actually make a difference in their own communities.
Think and act locally. That's what it's all about.
And Dubois' work shows us that change starts right there at the local level, each of us taking ownership, whether it's education, economic opportunities, fighting for more just policies, there's so much we can do.
Yeah, and for our listeners in Southeast Houston, we encourage you to get involved. You know, find those organizations doing good work, use your voice, take action. Even small steps can make a difference.
I love that. Small steps, big impact. It's about that collective action, that community spirit that Dubois talks about, coming together to fight injustice and build something better.
That's a great note to end on. And speaking of community, I want to remind everyone that Think and Act Locally is listener-supported. If you enjoy our deep dives, consider donating at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. Links in the show notes. Every donation helps us keep these conversations going, helps us empower local action. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and keep thinking and acting locally.